situation where we can basically make them afraid.
Absolutely.
Like, once again, we've been
because
there before.
They've gone too comfortable after, and I was born in 94, for the
right.
reference, I'm 24. So talking about the Soviet Union is definitely more historical to me than for some other people and some of our older comrades.
Yeah, some of them actually have been there.
Yeah.
Right?
But, I mean, from what I'm seeing, it just seems that ever since the dissolution of the USSR, there's just been no fear from the capitalists about working class power.
Mm-hmm.
They've been able
certainly a lot less.
To take much bigger cuts, and they haven't had to make an effort because there's nowhere else for working class people to look.
Yeah, like an alternative system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that's exactly the point that Michael Parenti makes in Black Shirts and Reds, right? Is he's talking about like how in that book he writes about what the impact of the fall of the Soviet Union really was on working class people around the world. And really it was that. A lot of it had to do with now the bosses, they don't feel so intimidated. They don't feel like there's this alternative system like that can, mm-hmm. you know, workers can really rally around and say, this is us. This is something we can identify with.
You can look at the military-industrial complex and say that before, I mean, at the end of the Second World War, the major imperialist powers, the United States, Canada, Britain, none of them demilitarized.
No.
They did not stop producing weapons. They didn't stop producing vehicles used for war. And there, I think that's one of the biggest fears with our program. That's such a big economic drive for capitalism that they fear peace.
Mm-hmm. Like they're afraid of peace. Well, I know that that was the case with the when the negotiations actually happened between Trump and Kim Jong-un around, you know, like the conflict mm-hmm. on the Korean Peninsula. You know, defense stocks take a dip just because that happened. And
yeah,
that was all that was necessary to make their stocks drop. You know, and obviously that's not in their interest. Like for there to be peace, for there to be negotiations, for there to be any sort of like
no, and that's
peaceful
that's where
resolution.
The contradictions come in, I think, between like the traditional establishment Republicans and the alt right that are really like the burgeoning force now in the Republican
oh, yeah.
Party. That the alt right, they're very protectionist. Because they want to build their ethno state.
Yeah, like the white ethno state.
Shutting it off.
Yeah, and that's the you know the difference you could say there.
Yeah, they. That's definitely the difference. Whereas the Republicans are just straight up imperialists. They'll just keep going country to country, and you know, giving people democracy.
It's like, oh yeah, you know. Well, just in the Korean example, look what they did. Like, okay, they're going to impose democracy after the Second World War. It's his name is Syngman Rhee, and he's going to be your right-wing dictator. And he's going to, like, just, you know, in the collaboration with the U.S. Army, he's going to massacre anybody who opposes him.
I found that interesting that, because I visited South Korea last year.
Right.
And I did go on a tour of the demilitarized zone. Now, when I... They showed you, like, the whole history. They made jabs at communism, but they left out some things, and that was interesting. They did not talk about the military dictatorship
mm-hmm.
in South Korea. They did not talk about the massacre of communists on the island of Jeju.
Yeah.
And one of the tour guides herself was from Jeju. So
right. It's like very, you know, close to home.
Yeah. So there's definitely, it's definitely really hard, harder than most people make out to try and trust news that comes out of the Koreas.
Mm-hmm.
Because on both sides, they're still very much in the middle of this war.
Yeah. But that's why, of course, it's also very exciting, the fact like, okay, you have like 80% support for peace.
Oh yeah,
like in South Korea. I mean, it's this is the thing which the mainstream media in North America is really trying to minimize right now, is the fact that there is such overwhelming support among Koreans themselves, like for this conflict to end.
Oh yeah, I saw a video on May Day, South Korea, they were singing the Internationale.
Yeah.
It's illegal to do that. It goes against the anti-communist laws.
Right. Yeah, like the national security law or whatever it is, whatever it's called, right? Yeah, I mean, and that shows you how like powerful that movement is. I mean, that's the movement that, you know, the workers' movement in South Korea, like the peace movement in South Korea, that's had to go through like multiple dictatorships and then through like ruthless like neoliberal regimes in the 1990s and all this sort of stuff. And it survived. Not only has it survived, it's like just, you know, grown stronger. And it's like, it's if there's going to be peace, it's largely going to be because of people like that.
Yeah.
And that kind of mobilization. That's pretty inspiring. Like, I remember hearing like just all about that. Just floors me every time.
No,
every
I was
time.
Very upset just today. The news that Donald Trump decided to reverse his decision.
Oh yeah.
Now the stance he's taking is that DPRK is still a legitimate threat against U.S. security.
Yeah, once again, showing you cannot rely on the you know, the imperialists
yeah, it's like
to negotiate in good faith.
It took 9 days for him to flip his mind.
Yeah, it's just
and it was
once ridiculous.
Again, I think that was emblematic of the current struggle within their own ranks.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the alt-right, they want the U.S. out of everything because they want to focus internally. They want to keep going after immigrants. They want to go after refugees and minorities.
Yeah.
But the Republicans, the old guard Republicans, are still very much trying to protect the empire.
Yeah. So, but yeah, like talking about the movement in South Korea, I mean, it's this is the kind of thing that does make imperialism tremble and what makes capitalism tremble. And this is really, I think you'll agree with me on this, is the kind of thing that we do need in this part of the world and that we need to build, you know, this this kind of mobilizing workers, mobilizing, you know, across cultures, across like all the divides that exist, you know, just building that kind of movement that really can fight back and really can just, yeah, ultimately create a socialist society that actually will defeat these kind of systemic injustices that we see.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And the only way that we can move forward with that is that we need more people to stand up.
Mm-hmm.
We need to create our own leaders. We need to create our own heroes for this movement.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's the thing. The only way you can do that is by struggling.
Absolutely.
And these leaders and these heroes and these movements and all this stuff, they will emerge. Like through that. And it looks like to me, I mean, you've definitely played your part. You know, you've done what you had to do. I really want to commend you for like how you've done the election. It does take a lot of courage to do that.
And, thank you.
Yeah, and I'm really, yeah. This has been really great having you on. And I guess we probably should kind of wrap up now because it's been like more than an hour. But
oh, that's fair.
This has been great. I mean, I'm really enjoyed this discussion.
Oh, I have too, Siegfried. This has been really good. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Yeah, no problem. Like, and I'll definitely, you can come back anytime. Absolutely.
Awesome.
All right. Okay, so you take care, Clara.
All right, take care.
Okay, bye. Okay, so that was Clara Sorrenti of the Communist Party of Canada on the, you know, the recent candidate in the provincial election in London North Centre in... riding in London, and we just talked for quite some time there, like over about an hour. I didn't exactly anticipate the that it would go on for quite that long, but nonetheless, that was a very important issues that we did talk about there. So anyways, I'm just going to take a bit of a breather. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
The people's flag is deepest red, it shrouded off the mass of dead. And ere the limbs grew stiff and cold, their heart's blood died in every fold. Then raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and trick or sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. One dollar head in darkest night. It witnessed many a deed and vow. One mustn't change its color now. Blaze and scarlet standing high. Beneath your foes we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. It well recalls the triumphs past. It gives the hope of peace at last. The banner bright, plain of human rights and human gain. Praise the scarlet standard high. Beneath its folds we'll never die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. His mind's affixed on health and place. The cringe beneath the rich man's frown and all that sacred emblem down. Raise the scarlet standard high. Beneath its foes we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. With heads uncovered, swear we all to bear it onward till we fall. Dungeons dark or gallows grim, this song should be our parting hymn. Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
Hi, I'm Handel, and I volunteer at CFRU because I love working with the people here, and I also love the feeling of contributing something meaningful to the world.
CFRU is always looking for new volunteers. No experience is necessary and all the training is free. If you would like to get involved, email volunteer@cfru.ca.
Hi, my name is Jeff and I love CFRU because it introduces me to all kinds of music I would otherwise not have heard. And there's a vending machine down the hall.
Are you interested in rock and roll's impact on the world? Tune in Fridays at noon to CFRU 93.3 FM for Power Up with Electrified Voltage. For rockin' vibes from around the world, tune in to hear us rock the nations.
Hi there, my name is Gabriella, and I'm the Executive Director of the Guelph Youth Music Center. I'm excited to invite you to Bella Serata on Saturday, June 23rd at 7 p.m. The theme is We Could Have Danced All Night. There'll be wonderful food by some of the area's finest restaurants and caterers, delectable desserts, libation, an extraordinary silent auction, plus music performances in the acoustically exceptional recital hall. The evening will feature cool jazz by the Nick McLean Trio. Tickets include all food and beverages, live performances, and dancing. A charitable tax receipt for a portion of the adult tickets will be issued. Call 519-837-1119 for tickets or information, or visit gymc.ca. Don't miss Bella Serata, June 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Guelph Youth Music Center, 75 Cardigan Street, a physically accessible location.
listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. This is something I did touch on. We touched on briefly in my discussion with Clara Sorrenti before the break. But I want to say a few words on the barbaric detention of migrant children by American authorities, something which only recently made the news when it was revealed that children were being forcibly separated from their parents by immigration agents before being detained en masse in what amount of concentration camps for children. Like, it's just horrific. And I mean, it's a crime. Like, this is basically a crime against humanity right here. And, you know, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau gave his usual lukewarm criticism of the Donald Trump administration and said something to the effect that, you know, this is not the way we do things in Canada. Well, he's wrong. In recent years, Canada has detained hundreds of migrant children from the Middle East, West Africa, Central America, and the Caribbean. In February 2017, the Invisible Citizens, Canadian Children in Immigration Detention study, produced by the International Human Rights Program at the University of Toronto's Faculty of Law, revealed that there were 48 children being detained at the Toronto Immigration Holding Center alone at that time, including infants and toddlers. You know, and so putting migrant children behind bars is not just an American phenomenon. You know, regardless of what Justin Trudeau says otherwise, Canada does not have clean hands in this. And very notably, continues to classify the United States as a safe country for refugees, which it most certainly is not. So I really want to play a... Oscar Leone is he's basically a documentary filmmaker who does some work with the Real News Network. I have quite a bit of respect from him. He's from Ecuador originally, and he did about a 10-minute piece for the Real News concerning this, the detention of migrant children by American authorities. He did a very good piece earlier this week about that. So I'm going to play that right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
The world is enraged, but the cages are not new. A silent crisis brewing for a decade, now it's boiling. Despite the more than 4 million immigrants deported by Obama, his successor faces a wave of refugees crossing the US-Mexican border to escape poverty and violence. The steps that President Donald J. Trump and Attorney General Jeffrey Sessions have taken to deal with it have enraged the country, the last of which broke on Thursday, June 19, by AP. Baby jails were being set up to house unaccompanied minors of tender age, as they call them. In other words, immigrant babies. The next day, the pressure was simply too much, and Donald J. Trump announced signing an executive order to stop the separation of families. But let's look at the build-up that led to this moment. The news had quickly spread around the world. The United States of America was separating children. Over the last month and a half, an estimate of 2,000 minors who were accompanied had been put in detention centers, whether they had crossed illegally or had surrendered in ports of entry, in many cases in groups of people who were seeking asylum, escaping poverty and gang violence in Central America. Even the United Nations call on the United States of America to stop separating families.
There is nothing normal about detaining children. As I said, detention is never in the best interest of the child and always constitutes a child rights violation. On this being a criminal offense, as I said, this should, entry into a country without the right papers should at most be an administrative offense, and it certainly does not warrant jailing children.
Headlines like, children separated from their families crying in cages. The Bible is used to justify the separation of immigrant families in the United States. Frightened children are being ripped from their parents' arms and taken to overflowing detention centers, which are effectively cages. The reference by General Attorney Jeff Sessions to St. Paul's Roman 13 letter, in which the saint made a call to follow Roman law and avoid immigrating to the capital, ignited outrage in both Christian and Catholic communities, with many congregations of all kinds having meetings to discuss what to do, facing the horrible reality of what Erika Guevara Rosas, Amnesty International's America director, described as
nothing short of torture. The severe mental suffering that officials have intentionally inflicted on these families for coercive purposes means that these acts meet the definitions of torture under both U.S. and international law.
Children were separated from their parents and put in cages inside temporary detention centers, awaiting its transfer to facilities like this former Walmart in Brownsville, Texas. Their relatives will be sent to federal prisons like Eloy and Florence in Arizona. According to the Trump administration's own words, there is no system in place to reunite these families. In Phoenix, Arizona, inclusive and progressive churches are working with grassroots organizations to spread awareness and raise their voices of disapproval.
Personally, I kind of understand it as a fear of brown skin or black skin or anybody outside of white Anglo. And so for me, it's also an issue of race, it's an issue of justice, it's an issue of economics, it's an issue of power, who has power, and who is really considered human and inhuman. This is our way to tell you to stop coming across our border because we're going to take your children.
Reverend James Pennington is a senior minister at the First Congregational United Church of Christ in Phoenix, Arizona. By all definitions, an inclusive church.
And we received several individuals in sanctuary, and also 2 years ago we started a immigration legal clinic that was sponsored by and run by the church.
This time the church had called for a town hall where a panel of legal and social workers shared their expertise on the matter to an outraged public.
And now they're transferring those children into ORR custody.
Patrick Helling, managing attorney for the Florence Project, an NGO that provides legal assistance to migrants, confirmed what had been reported. Children had been separated from their parents and eventually placed in custody in facilities different than those of their relatives, whom, according to the latest anti-immigrant laws, are not entitled to bail and will remain incarcerated until they are deported. More temporary detention facilities are being erected, like this tent city jail in Tornillo, Texas, designed for housing families and children until further processing and eventual transfer. The immigrant kids that turn 18 and have not been reunified with a sponsor will be sent to general prison population. Carmen Smith Strada from the Florence Project confirmed this.
There are a number of kids that arrive just before they turn 18 who will be transferred to detention centers for adults. If no one claims them, or they don't qualify for a bond, or if they can't pay the bond given to them, they will face a dire choice: sitting in jail until its case sorts itself out, or choose being sent back to their countries.
The panel did notice that there is a way to help for those who are willing to join and support groups like the Phoenix Restoration Project and others, doing hospitality work and claiming those minors before they are surrendered to the general prison system. Jessica Brown, social worker with the Florence Project, who works with the actual children in detention, confirmed the severity of the trauma experienced by the caged children.
Not only the trauma of what we're handing back home, the trauma of throughout their journey up to the U.S., but then arriving here, being split from the family, the protective parent that's been with them, and then not knowing really what's going to happen.
Through the 2 hours of the town hall meeting, people kept relating to the immigrant families and comparing the caged children to their own. Even a group of mothers was formed to take direct, peaceful action in the matter.
I've known that this has been happening for a long time, but seeing a lot of pictures in the news and videos of the actual children has really inspired me to want to stop this, like, right now.
As a mom, I have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, and they're both of Latino descent. And so every time I see the reports on the news of children being ripped away from their mothers, from their fathers, it just makes me so I can't even sleep at night.
I think one thing that we're facing with this issue of family separation is it's an acute form of state violence. And it's not a violence that leaves physical marks upon children, upon families, but the violence that it does to those attachment bonds, to the bond of a parent and a child, can leave lasting traumatic effects upon these communities. So I think we're creating a problem that's going to be going to have effects for generations to come. They are being placed in an institution at a very tender age. This reminds me of the institutionalization of Native Americans in boarding schools, not very far past in our nation's history, right? Does that mean that that they're going to be taught that their parents were indeed criminals?
Speaking at Laura Ingraham's show, General Attorney Jeff Sessions, or General Sessions, as she called him, struggled trying to explain the difference between today's United States and 1940s Third Reich Germany.
Nazi Germany, concentration camps, human rights violations. Laura Bush has weighed in, Michelle Obama, Rosalind Carter, got all the first ladies going back to Eleanor Roosevelt. She's apparently weighed in as well. General Sessions, what's going on here?
Well, it's a real exaggeration. Of course, in Nazi Germany, they were keeping the Jews from leaving the country.
It's the paradigm of the wagon train versus the swarthy hordes, first enunciated very well by in a marvelous article by Tom Engelhardt in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It could be happening in the American Wild West. It could be in the Amazon jungle, the North African desert, the Sudan, the Transvaal, the South Pacific jungles, or Indochina. The scene is generally the same. There's a fort, or an encampment, or a wagon train. And inside that encampment are the human beings. They're white. They're human. They're warm. They're attractive. They talk and they're nice. Outside come the swarthy hordes, the savages. They can be Indians. They can be Bushmen. They can be Arabs on camels and horses or whatever else. And they are the subhumans and they are attacking the human beings. And the wagons form their circle. And the human beings know what to do. They level their guns and they begin to knock off, shoot, and kill these screaming savages who attack them. Why do the swarthy hordes attack the white people? You don't know. They never tell you. Is it to protect their lands? Is it to protect their herds? Is it to protect their villages and their towns and their families and their children? No, it's just because they like to do that. That's their thing. They like to attack. And so they have to be killed. And by the way, it's not even bravery that they manifest. As they charge in great numbers and get cut down in horrible numbers, this is not even bravery. Although similar acts by whites would be portrayed as heroic. This itself is portrayed as a manifestation of the swarthy hordes, their fanatic, crazed way of wanting to bloodlust. Now the trouble with this paradigm... The trouble with this paradigm is that it turns the history of the last 400 years on its head. That it reverses the roles of usurper and usurped. It reverses the roles of victim and victimizer. It reverses the roles of those who were massacred and those who were doing the massacring. It was the European and North American civilizers, so-called, who went in there and destroyed the villages and destroyed their industries and destroyed their townships. Read Engels on North Africa, what happened to the Arabs and Berbers, and when he goes in and describes the beautiful towns with the fine, hard stone and plaster buildings and their woolen industries and their mining industries and their arts and crafts and all that. And then read the description of the French troops coming in and systematically destroying it and killing every man, woman, and child. Read about how the Germans went into South Africa and killed the Herero tribe. 80,000 people, they killed 60,000 of them, and the other 20,000 they used as slave labor in their minds. Read Mark Twain's angry, raging comments about King Leopold of Belgium. calling him a mad dog and what he did to the innocent, unoffending people of the Congo, taking them and enslaving them, a million of them a year dying in the mines in the Congo. That's what the history's about. That's what John Wayne is about. And what these films do is they reverse that history, stand it on its head. They do what Joseph Goebbels said. They give you a big lie, and they embellish it, and they make you root for the guys in the wagon train.
Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino por no llevar papel. Pa' una ciudad del norte yo me fui a trabajar. Mi vida la dejé entre Ceuta y Gibraltar. Soy una raya en el mar, fantasma en la ciudad. Mi vida va prohibida, dice la autoridad. Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino por no llevar papel. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino, yo soy el quiebra ley. Mano negra clandestina, peruano clandestino, africano clandestino, marihuana ilegal. Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino por no llevar papel. Argelino clandestino, nigeriano clandestino, boliviano clandestino, mano negra ilegal.
Je suis la fille de Kilamati, de Matissa, de Kilamati, de Zosso. Je suis le Simon Moun, je suis le Caravan, de la Chine, je suis le Mauritania. Je suis le Rambach, le Gazir, de la Diakta, le Wahid, de la Diakta.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Manu Chao with his song Clandestino. And, you know, we heard from Michael Parenti there. I decided it was appropriate to play his song, his, not song, but I mean the talk he gave about the paradigm of the wagon train versus the swarthy hordes, because I think that really comes out in the Oscar Leone's report for The Real News about the detention of migrant children in the United States. You know, I mean, the United States basically, once again, like, you know, they're the white people circling the wagons, and here come these immigrant children who they're treating as the swarthy hordes, you know, who need to be persecuted, locked in cages, you know, terrorized and separated from their parents and all this sort of stuff. And like, yeah, and of course Jeff Sessions is gonna come out and basically say, you know, This is the powers that be are ordained of God, so that justifies this horrific law, this horrific policy of brutalizing kids. You know, I mean that's what's going on here. It's racist. It's imperialistic. It's one of the most horrific things imaginable. Like this kind of thing. And of course, like seeing pictures of these facilities in the U.S. You know, of course, like you know, you do see you know kids in cages. And, you know, like behind bars and getting marched, you know, like in lines, you know, chained together, this sort of thing by officials, like immigration officials, this sort of thing. Like, this is what's going on. And it's the most barbaric thing imaginable, you know, and it's just, yeah, like this is, I mean, obviously, I don't really have too much more time to really talk about this. I could do a whole show on this, and, you know, I probably will at some point in the near future. But I think where I'll go from here is I'll actually play another clip from Michael Parenti, which talks about how imperialists try to manufacture propaganda to justify their horrific deeds by appealing to things such as like human nature and like all, you know, because I mean, they appeal to religion, they appeal to human nature, they appeal to all these kind of like, you know, things to justify what it is that they, the crimes, the horrific abuses that they perpetrate, you know, at home and abroad, all over the world. You know, this is the kind of thing that that goes on. I mean, you know, they try to justify, the American state tries to justify like its horrific treatment of immigrant children. They also try to justify like the horrific treatment of you know, the people that they bomb in Afghanistan and Iraq and in Syria and these kind of places. I mean, and in Libya, you know, the countries they invade and destroy. You know, they try to use all kinds of justifications for these kind of things, and they historically have. You know, like this goes back hundreds of years. You know, ever since like European colonialism, basically it goes back to 1492, when of course like Europeans, you know, burst upon the Americas and commit genocide against the indigenous people here, and then take imperialism all over the world, right? That's the kind of thing that you know, and they use all these kind of arguments. You know, appeals to religion, appeal to human nature, appeals to science, appeals to like, you know, you name it, you know, to dehumanize the people that they are brutalizing. So that's a very important part of history to understand. And so I'm going to play this this clip from Michael Parenti right here. And this is where he gets into this. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Now, then you got about 5 centuries of imperialism coming along. And imperialism was when the powers of Western Europe began to expropriate the land, labor, and wealth of Eastern Europe. That was the first area of expansion and exploitation that they went into. And the second was the New World. And then having developed all the superior firepower and mobility and transportation, they went then into Africa and Asia and further into Latin America. And with this imperialism, which is a history that really, to read the history of modern imperialism, as it's still going on today, to read that history is really to read a history of a succession of the most horrendous, horrible atrocities that one can imagine. Now, when the ruling classes of these imperialist nations plundered and exploited the land, the labor, the natural resources, and the markets of other people, when they enslaved their labor, when they burned their villages, when they destroyed their industries and their crafts and their mines and their herds and their crops, when they raped them and murdered them and mutilated them, when they did all that sort of thing, and they worked them to death in the latifundios and the plantations and in the mines, then theories had to come along to justify what you were doing. And the theories about these lesser races proliferated. These lesser races were animals. They were cruel savages. They were incapable of self-governance. They were like pathetic, helpless children. They'd been around living in peace for, you know, 5,000 years before you came along, but suddenly now they wouldn't be able to get along without us. They were devoid of the normal sensibilities that one might expect from a person in civilized societies. Again, not an anachronistic attitude. In my own lifetime, the lifetime of most of you, the adult lifetime of most of you, General Westmoreland, you remember him? Vietnam, your average Asian. The Asian doesn't place the same importance on life we Americans do. That's your average Asian. And with the massive bombings and saturation bombings, a war of horror and attrition and mass slaughter, he was pointing out that indeed one of those two protagonists did not place the same value on life as the other, but he had it mixed up, that's all. And with imperialism, there came in the 19th century the class-based, racist, patriarchal theories about human nature, known as science. Science came along and rushed in there with measurements of skulls and brain sizes. Whites were superior to blacks, males were superior to women, men of substance were superior to men of poverty. Race, gender, and class again. 19th century science gave us a great scientist, by the way, who took human beings out of the medieval metaphysical scheme of things and made them part of the natural order of things. And in a sense, it was a very revolutionary and very progressive thing that he did, a very great contribution, Charles Darwin. But a closer reading of some of the other things Darwin said in his Descent of Man, for instance, definitely shows him to be a product of 19th century science, which in turn is a product of 19th century imperialism and capitalism and upper-class white male Europeans. Darwin, quote, "Man is more courageous, pugnacious, and energetic than woman, and has a more inventive genius." This is the best scientific mind of the 19th century in England, British Royal Society. "Men are superior in every activity requiring deep thought, reason, or imagination," except imagination about women, I guess. Huh? "Men vastly excel in the sciences, philosophy, history, the arts, poetry, painting, and sculpture." Ready? Sisters, are you ready? Women excel in tenderness, unselfishness, intuition, imitation, and other qualities that are characteristic of the lesser races. Darwin argued, in effect, that women are less evolved biologically, evolutionarily. For Darwin, culture doesn't explain anything. By the way, it's true of most of these people. Cultural differences are the thing that needs to be explained. And these differences are explained as being grounded in biological development in human natures in the process of natural selection. In the Descent of Man, or natural selection, or both, combination of both, biological, innate biological structures and natural selection and development of those biological developments in natural selection. Let's turn to what Darwin had to say about races. Now, this is, we're talking right 1880. This is when England is building an empire upon which the sun never sets. At the time Darwin is saying this, the Brits are killing a variety of people from Ceylon to India to Malaysia to God knows where's Africa, or working them to death. Darwin thought that the sense of smell was more highly developed in darker races, as in animals, than in white civilized peoples. The same, by the way, with other physiological characteristics. The rudimentary ear lobule, the larger wisdom teeth, the more pronounced conical form of the canine teeth, and certain bone structures, all supposedly common to the darker races, and all, therefore, more proximate to animal physiology, testify to their less advanced evolutionary development. By the way, none of that's true. In case you want to go checking teeth. Here's Darwin talking. "Given, quote, the hideous ornaments and the equally hideous music admired by most savages," unquote, Darwin concluded that their aesthetic faculty was less developed than that of birds. I mean, what impresses you is the total oblivion, the total ignorance of the brutalities of imperialism, the total ignorance of the adverse effects on the health and survival of native peoples that imperialism had when they came into exposure to European diseases. The deracination, the mistreatment, the deaths. Darwin looks at this. He discusses some particular tribe that dies out. I think it was a tribe in the American Southwest. Says they died out. He concluded that the extinction of these tribes, when they came in contact with whites, was evidence of their lesser biological capacity, their immunity systems, their capacities, and such. Nothing having to do with starvation. Nothing having to do with injecting smallpox into blankets and then selling them to the Indians. Nothing having to do with the Gatling gun and the Maxim gun and mass murder. They die out because they're lesser. Savages snarled more often and had less control of their fear reactions and sphincter muscles than did Europeans, Darwin said. Now, how did he suppose he found that out? And what did he do to study that one? I don't know. It's not the kind of research I'd want to do. "Thus, they were more like monkeys and dogs in that respect." That's from The Descent of Man. "Civilized males were less emotive than savages and less inclined to weep." Now, even among civilized males, there were ethnic and evolutionary differences, by the way. Englishmen rarely cried or shrugged their shoulders energetically, while Frenchmen and Italians were given to such less advanced displays. Why the absence of shrugging of shoulders is seen as an evolutionary gain is not clear to me. I don't understand. You see, but you're getting this very interesting convolution. You're getting you're getting the trait of what is assumed to be the more evolved person as evidence of that evolution. So on the one hand, right, that Englishman manifests these traits, therefore these traits must be the more evolved traits. He has these more evolved traits, therefore he is more evolved. And the thing just kind of self-fulfills itself. Darwin, by the way, is rather ignorant of the so-called lesser peoples. I mean, if you ever want to, he mentioned the Italians, if you ever wanted to see a people, southern Italian peasants, who I'm sure he would feel very uncomfortable being in the same room with, if you ever wanted to see a people, having come from that stock myself, all my grandparents, both sides, if you want to see a people who had a rigorous idea of social strictures and interpersonal diplomacy and what was proper and what was hospitality and what you said and what you didn't say and how you presented this and didn't present that. Or if you go to any savage society, so-called savage, or primitive peoples, native peoples, indigenous peoples, anywhere, whether it be American Indians or Melanesians, again, the same thing. Elaborate codes, certainly as elaborate, as advanced, as subtle, as nuanced as anything you could find in upper-class English society. Maybe not quite as stuffy, but certainly they were there. The fact that he was ignorant of them, the fact that he never saw or talked to one of these people, except to glance at them from the side of his boat, doesn't mean that it didn't exist, you see. And by the way, there was a very interesting thing that happened in the British Royal Society, where a debate broke out between Darwin and his closest collaborator, Wallace, where Wallace got up and suddenly started making very strange statements, because they had a problem. The problem was, if the human brain is a manifestation of the level of evolution, why is the savage brain not vastly small? Why is it roughly the same or so large as the white British European brain? They had these gradations. Thomas Huxley was another one who believed it. He said the most highly evolved are the Europeans. The most highly evolved of the Europeans are the upper class. The most highly evolved of them are the upper class Englishmen. The most highly evolved of them are the members of our British Royal Society. Me. Why could the world be more like me, right? Huxley, with all the characteristic modesty of his class, decided it had that hierarchy. That was Darwin's hierarchy, too. But they had this problem. If the savages had such good brains, why weren't they more evolved? And Wallace got up and he says, you know, I don't think this is a problem, because I think they are evolved. And the thing about Wallace is he had lived in Melanesia for about 2 years. He says, I've lived with these people, and I find among them people who have a range of intelligence and subtlety and imagination and gift and craft and science within the confines of their material culture and all, which the best among them could compare favorably with members of our British Royal Society. And there was a gasp, of course. That was like saying, down with the Queen or something. And that was the difference between Wallace and, on one hand, and Huxley and Darwin on the other.
Right.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Eric Voice, Aboriginal Canadian artist there with his song Louis Riel. And before that, we had Michael Parenti talking about imperialism and how human nature, ideas about human nature, have been used to try to justify, you know, imperialist violence throughout history. So we've come to the end of another episode of Back in the USSR, and I want to thank you all for joining me, you know, here on CFRU. And I want to sign off here with a speech I have not played on the show in a long time. This is Charlie Chaplin's final speech from his film The Great Dictator. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR, and I'll see you all next week.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes, men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives. Tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel? Who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder? Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate. Only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world. A decent world that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power, but they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason, a world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
CFRU 93.3 FM.
Hi, I'm Handel, and I volunteer at CFRU because
because I love working with the people here, and I also love the feeling of contributing something meaningful to the world.
CFRU is always looking for new volunteers. No experience is necessary, and all the training is free. If you would like to get involved, email volunteer@cfru.ca.
Hi, my name is Jeff, and I love CFRU because it introduces me to all kinds of music I would otherwise not have heard. And there's a vending machine down the hall.
Are you interested in rock and roll's impact on the world? Tune in Fridays at noon to CFRU 93.3 FM for Power Up with Electrified Voltage. For rock and vibes from around the world, tune in to hear us rock the nations.
Hi there, my name is Gabriella, and I'm the Executive Director of the Guelph Youth Music Center. I'm excited to invite you to Bella Serata on Saturday, June 23rd at 7 p.m. The theme is We Could Have Danced All Night. There'll be wonderful food by some of the area's finest restaurants and caterers, delectable desserts, libation, an extraordinary silent auction, plus music performances in the acoustically exceptional recital hall. The evening will feature cool jazz by the Nick McLean Trio. Tickets include all food and beverages, live performances, and dancing. A charitable tax receipt for a portion of the adult tickets will be issued. Call 519-837-1119 for tickets or information, or visit gymc.ca. Don't miss Bella Serata, June 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Guelph Youth Music Center, 75 Cardigan Street, a physically accessible location.
You are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM. I'm Adi, taking over for DJ Vulgar this week. And you're listening to The Underground. Stay locked.